Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. I almost said welcome back to it, but gotta wait till at least come back from the first break for that, right? Yeah. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Some people just like the interviews. Some people like the whole show. Choose one and be it. I'm sorry, I got Fox News out of the corner of my left eye, and it's all these bad guys from the Islamic State, and they're all driving Dodge Rams that probably came directly from the United States of America by way of the U.S. State Department, and a bunch of Toyota Helixes, which, of course, the Saudis bought for the FSA, and the State Department delivered to the FSA, and they were then, what, bought, sold, or traded, or stolen? And are now in the hands of the Islamic State. But you're just not supposed to notice that big ram symbol on the front of this ISIS truck. Is that one that David Petraeus gave to the concerned local citizens? Or is it one that Obama and Hillary gave to the mythical moderates fighting in Syria? Yeah. So I don't know. Today on the show, Gareth Porter is going to talk about the Iran deal. And Patrick Coburn is going to talk about the war in Syria and the refugee crisis and the Turks and this and that and the other thing. So that should be very important. I'll try to remember to just blow through the original, you know, the middle break there. And keep Patrick for the full half hour. Or maybe I should keep Gareth for the full half hour. On the Iran thing. I guess, chat room guys, you decide who you think. You know, you can wait until you hear them both. And then tell me which. No, because you got to tell me before. So I know which break to blow. Would you rather hear Gareth or Patrick on KPFK on Sunday morning? That's the question. That's the one that I'll blow through the break and get a full half hour interview. But anyway, so Gareth on the Iran deal and related issues. Patrick Coburn on the current state of the terror war. All right. Yesterday, I was interviewed by Christopher Cantwell on his show. And you can find that at radicalagenda.com, I think, is it? Well, let me see here. You can find it at scotthorton.org/stress. scotthorton.org/stress. And then I link to the YouTube there. Now when I go to YouTube, is it going to show me his website address? Well, I guess I'll just have to Google it then. Radical Agenda with Christopher Cantwell is the name of the show. And yeah, it's christophercantwell.com, I guess. somegarbagepodcast.com. That sounds like might be it. It was good, though. It was a good interview. Radical Agenda. Yeah, somegarbagepodcast.com. If you want to find it. And then let's see if it's at christophercantwell.com, too. Looks like it is. Yeah, there you go. christophercantwell.com. And, yeah, it was all right. And then last night I hosted Jacob Hornberger for our new show on liberty.me. Which is called, surprise, The Future of Freedom. That was our second episode of The Future of Freedom. And we talked about the wars and other things. So that was pretty cool. 2 days ago, on Tuesday night, I did Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker. We talked about the wars and some things there. You know me, I'm kind of a broken record on this stuff, but at least I'm right. So, yeah, there's that. And, well, anyway, I guess I just want to kind of celebrate the success of the Iran deal at this point. Yesterday, the Senate attempted to pass the Republicans tried to pass the anti-Iran deal resolution, and they failed. They didn't need 51 votes. They needed 61. And they failed 58 to 42. So that's it. And then in the House of Representatives, I guess I'm only making this up. It's just my speculation for political reasons. Oh, I said this on the show yesterday. For political reasons, I guess they don't want to go ahead and try to advance the resolution since it's already failed in the Senate. So they've decided to use nitpick excuses for not even holding the vote on the anti-Iran resolution. And their excuse is a completely bogus one. It's Justin Amash's excuse. And Justin Raimondo dismantles it in his piece at antiwar.com today. Because there's a secret side deal with the IAEA, that means that the administration hasn't lived up to the Iran Review Act and the language in there. But that's just the side deal with the IAEA, not with the United States. The U.S. doesn't have it to reveal, and there's nothing scandalous about it, despite whatever Republican talking points you heard. We're talking about a nuclear program. All of it is classified and confidential, and so if Iran or any other country has a deal with the IAEA on the nitty-gritty of how the inspections are to be carried out, that's always top secret. Doesn't mean it's because they're covering up. And what are we supposed to believe here? That the entire UN Security Council plus Germany, including the United States, made a deal and with the IAEA where they leave some giant loophole in their secret deal with the IAEA? The best accusation you can get out of that is complete, you know, falsehood. Oh, Iran gets to inspect themselves. Jeez. I don't know. Is that what you call it when there's a IAEA inspector from a European country standing right there videotaping the whole thing, putting the sample in his evidence bag and taking it away? And they had precedent. Yosef Butt explained. In Syria, where they pretended that it was a nuclear facility that the Israelis bombed in 2007, their so-called proof that it was came from a rogue swipe by an IAEA inspector who claimed he got it from the floor of the bathroom. There was no matching sample, no control sample from the same place. And his sample alone, supposedly, and he kept it in his shirt pocket instead of putting it in a plastic bag. And then his sample alone supposedly provided evidence of uranium isotopes there and whatever. Total hoax. So they have, you know, every reason to say, here, we do the swipe and put it in your bag right there. They're standing there watching. None of this is scandalous. None of this is a trick. I guess they could hire Iranian magicians to do the swiping, but I think probably not. And anyway, they're not going to find anything at Parchin anyway, which is what this is all about, because it's bogus. A bunch of ridiculous, bogus accusations. You can tell because they came from the Israelis by way of the MEK communist terrorist cult. And they're always wrong. Except when they're telling you something that's already in the open record, you know. I'm off on the tangent. The point is, that's the House's excuse. That the so-called secret side deal is the House's excuse, including Justin Amash's excuse for opposing the deal or even holding a vote to oppose the deal. Their way of weaseling out. But now it's on to, you know, their next plan is to pass new sanctions and to do everything they can to try to undermine the deal in other ways. If the president was able to really twist enough arms and lobby hard enough to see this deal through, then can he maintain that same block in the House and the Senate on every single new Iran resolution that the Republicans are going to send down the pike, meant to be poison pills to basically to make it easier for the Iranian right to say, see, the Americans don't mean to live up to the deal, they're trying to sabotage it, so that they, to try to force them out, to convince them to quit it by dealing in bad faith? Guess we'll see. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. Oh, I guess the House is voting on whether to approve the Iran deal now. Doesn't matter, they already failed in the Senate. Man, I never have enough time to fit in all I want to talk about. Hey, chat room guys, remind me to make sure to talk about Israeli nukes in this segment. I want to talk about Israeli nukes in this segment. It's important. But I got to tell you about the Iran deal. Now, here's the deal. For anyone who has been subject to a lot of anti-Iran deal shtick, I think if you really squint and pay close attention, even if you lean that way, I think that you'll have to recognize that there's a lot of sloganeering and not a lot of detail in the opposition to the deal. In the detail, what the deal accomplishes, from, you could argue, I guess, that there's a big loophole in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT does not outlaw enrichment of uranium. As long as it's enrichment for civilian use, then they have every right, an unalienable right, in fact, under the treaty, to enrich uranium, to master the fuel cycle, to figure out exactly how best to enrich uranium, which means they could, if they wanted to, enrich to weapons grade. The only thing about that is they couldn't do it in secret. It'd be absolutely, okay, it'd be virtually impossible for them to sneak out and make a nuclear weapon by diverting from their safeguarded nuclear program. They're already safeguarded civilian nuclear program. But what this current deal does is it blocks even the possibility of them being able to make a nuke if they did decide to break out and leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty and decide we do want to make a nuke now. This makes it guaranteed that that would take at least a year for them to get enough weapons-grade uranium to even be able to make a nuke out of that, and which is still another thing. When they say breakout time, they just mean the time that it would take to make enough weapons-grade material, full stop. Nothing past that. Never mind making an actual bomb out of it, an actual warhead, and fitting that into a delivery vehicle and fitting that onto a missile or any of these other things. Okay, that would give at least a year. And the way that it does that is it guarantees that European scientists, and I think even American scientists, will be in on redesigning and reconfiguring the Iraq reactor so it's no longer a heavy water reactor. And it will not produce weapons-grade plutonium. And they also swear not to make a reprocessing facility where they would be able to ever reprocess that waste and get weapons-grade plutonium out of it. Which, again, they wouldn't even the waste would be so polluted in a light water reactor with other isotopes, even with a separate facility, they wouldn't be able to get weapons-grade plutonium out of that, period. But so now they're going to not have a reprocessing facility, and it's going to be a light water and not a heavy water reactor. And by the way, the only way, even if it was still a heavy water reactor, the only way they could get weapons-grade plutonium out of it would be to shut the damn thing off for a year, and then have the Russians would have to come in and help them take the lid off the whole damn thing and try to harvest all the plutonium out of there. Nothing. None of this could be done in secret, of course, whatsoever. Any route to weapons-grade plutonium in the hands of the Iranian regime is completely cut off by this deal. And then their uranium, they already have been spinning centrifuges since, I guess, 2006 at Natanz, and since 2010 at the COM facility, Fordo. And they're now turning the Fordo facility into a research facility with no nuclear material whatsoever. And they're reducing the number of spinning centrifuges at Natanz from 20,000 down to 5,000 spinning centrifuges. And they're reducing the stockpile of uranium that's still only enriched to industrial grade, electricity grade, 3.6%, which theoretically could be reintroduced into the centrifuges and enriched to weapons grade above 90%. They're reducing the stockpile down to very small amounts, basically just enough to get it ready for the next batch to go into the reactor, and nothing more than that. And they've already, according to all the interim deals, have been converting all of their uranium to fuel rods and fuel plates for their various reactors, making them, I guess, not impossible, but virtually impossible to turn back into a gaseous form and then, you know, try to enrich from there. So, in other words, I'm not done by a long shot. And they're expanding their inspections regime to facilities that don't even have nuclear materials, or at least by the previous definition. So they're going to be monitoring the mines, as well as the facility where they refine the ore into the yellow cake, which then later is at a facility that's already safeguarded, converted to hexafluoride gas for use in enrichment. But they're also expanding to the facility, the factory where they make the centrifuges, and to, everything with nuclear material is already safeguarded, but it's all going to now be 24 hours a day, even, you know, under the additional protocol, which they've signed on permanently, and the subsidiary arrangements, which they've signed on to permanently. They'll have an expanded inspections regime beyond any reason. And then, of course, they have to satisfy the IAEA on the so-called possible military dimensions and let them inspect Parchin at least one more time, I guess, and then that's it. And so they're giving up basically everything except their nuclear program. And then the slogan goes, they're not giving up anything, we're giving up everything, and they're giving up nothing. But, well, be specific. Because I just listed a whole bunch of things that they're doing at American insistence. And what is America doing in return for them? Letting them have some of their own money back. That's it. We're not paying them American welfare. We're not selling them weapons. We're not normalizing relations and trade between us and them in a normal way. We're not lifting all the sanctions on the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the IRGC and the, rounds of sanctions have been leveled against Iran for their support of terrorism or, you know, any other thing. There's layers and layers and layers of sanctions on Iran since 1979. It's just the nuclear sanctions that are being released. And that's it. America's not doing anything else for them at all. And I guess I was a little frustrated because last night before my show with Jacob Hornberger, the show that came on before us, they seemed like some really good guys, some really good libertarian guys, and they're interviewing Tom Woods about history and all this, and of course, I'm a big Tom Woods fan and friend and whatever. And then I saw them talking about the nuclear deal, and one of them was pretty good, and a couple of them were all right, and then one of them was pretty bad on it, but you could tell he really meant well, but he was just, he's heard all these slogans all the time about how bad this deal is. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be insulting, like reduce his argument to just slogans, but he was certainly not taking into account any of the things I just said about what Iran is doing in terms of reducing their program and expanding inspections. Like, that had nothing to do with it. No recognition that they've had a nuclear program for a decade now. We're not giving them a nuclear program. It was Gerald Ford and Richard Nixon gave them a nuclear program back when their government was an American-backed fascist sock puppet dictatorship. But that's a different question. That's not part of this deal. Oh yeah, Israel. Damn. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up.
And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, we got Anthrax back in the rotation here. It's Friday. I'm Scott Horton. I'm doing my radio show. Lucky for you. I got Gareth Porter on the line. He wrote the book on the Iranian nuclear program. It's called Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iranian Nuclear Scare. And he also writes for truthout.org and Middle East Eye. You can also find in the archives about 100,000 articles he wrote for Interpress Service. Virtually all of these things from all these places are rerun in his archive at antiwar.com as well. Not the Nation pieces, I guess. But the IPS and the rest, I think, all end up at antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing fine. Thanks. How are
good,
you?
Good, good. I'm doing good. Very happy to have you here. And so, well, you can rain on my parade all you want if you want to. I'll give you all the chance in the world to. But yesterday, the Senate failed, in all capital letters, in bold, in italics, to pass their anti-Iran resolution. 58-42 was the vote, and they didn't get their cloture, and so Obama doesn't even need to veto it, and they're not even going to get a chance to override his veto of it. In the House of Representatives, apparently they're voting right now, but no point in that, because it's already failed in the Senate, so it's not going to the president. So I'm sure they have other plans, and we talk all about the other plans that they have, but at least it looks like you know, they can try to sabotage it in other ways, but the deal itself will be implemented come New Year's Day. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And thank God for these undemocratic institutions that we have, like the Senate and its arcane rules of procedure. I'm being somewhat facetious, but nevertheless, you know, that has saved the bacon for the Obama administration and the Iran deal for sure. Because clearly the opponents of the agreement had a majority in the Senate and the House both, but they certainly didn't get the 2/3. And I mean, there will be an effort led by Ben Cardin, as I understand it, to put forward a so-called Iran oversight bill or act that will try to snatch the a victory from the jaws of the defeat on the floor by introducing a series of poison pills that would essentially make it impossible for the administration to implement the agreement. But I'm quite sure that will fail because it's going to be too obvious.
Right. Well, now, and so that's the question, right? Is Obama going to have to actually be able to maintain this same supermajority on all of these things? Or is it actually, I mean, it seems like kind of it makes sense for AIPAC to go this route that, well, you know, if we just pass new sanctions in the name of, I don't know, Syria or Hezbollah or, you know, some other thing, then maybe we'll be able to cajole more Democrats to sign on to something like that than to something like this, even though, like you say, it's pretty obvious it's sabotage. At least it kind of gives them an out that, hey, this is just about terrorism, and so I had to, that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, you're asking a good question, and I have to admit that I have not looked precisely at what the politics of or the legalities, I should say, of trying to pass a piece of legislation apart from the vote on the agreement itself will be. You know, it may be that they can get a majority, but the president can veto it, and then, you know, they would have to override it. So and that much is clear. I'm not sure exactly what the calculation of the opponents is in introducing this, but I assume that it's their last gasp.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of like seeing them whining and complaining and thrashing around as long as they lose. I just don't want them to figure out a way to make their evil plans stick, you know, that's all.
Well, that is, of course, the thing that we have to fear for sure.
All right. Now, so I hate to do this to you, but you know what? There are good people, well-meaning people who've been exposed to such scaremongering over this thing, And I guess I wouldn't have you confront the most cartoonish, ridiculous stuff, like, you know, the former vice president saying that Obama is handing the Iranians the means to attack us with nuclear weapons, which is, I mean, I don't think anybody is dumb enough to believe that. But there are people who, you know, even all the Democrats in the Senate signing on, Gareth, as the Republicans could tell you, even these Democrats say it's not a very good deal, but, oh, my president says so, and it's the best deal that we have now, and this kind of thing. Is this really a bad deal, or what would you say to well-meaning people who are taken in by the scaremongering and are afraid that Obama's really being fooled by the Iranians and is giving them the means to hurt us later on?
Scott, the only sense in which this is a bad deal is that it should never have been necessary in the first place. And, you know, I mean, there are people who are complaining that Iran is being deprived of its legitimate right to have more advanced nuclear technologies, and that of course is true, that they have to sacrifice, they have to put off for a period of years the ability to enrich uranium at higher not at higher levels but more efficiently, to have more efficient centrifuges to enrich their uranium. And I mean, you know, there is injustice built into this because of that. And as you know well, and I think most of your listeners know well, what I show in my book is that Iran has not tried to get nuclear weapons, that the evidence to the contrary is extremely flawed, or simply, you know, fabricated. So, you know, this is a situation where the Obama administration has, gone off on this tangent of, you know, forcing Iran, quote unquote, to agree not to have nuclear weapons, when in fact that was never an issue in reality. And, and the cost of this, I'm sorry to say, is extremely high, in the sense that, you know, the Obama administration has, helped to, make the argument that Iran is not only a terrorist, a state supporter of terrorism, but also, you know, trying to pursue nuclear weapons, not just a sort of right-wing rant, but, the Democratic Party's rant as well. And, that means that the Obama administration, is extremely limited. I mean, it helps to limit further, is probably the right way to formulate it, the flexibility of the Obama administration with regard to regional diplomacy. And that's a very serious problem, for all of us in the coming years.
Hey, tell me this. Why do you think Obama wanted to do this so bad anyway? He had to spend a lot of political capital to get this done, and he could have just kept the status quo and passed it off to his successor.
It's a very good question, Scott, and a lot of people have been asking that same question in interviews with me. And the answer is, I think I'm quite confident in saying this, that this administration, like all previous administrations, suffers from a complex of superiority in power over the rest of the world, and that includes Iran. And so this whole question of getting the Iranians to agree to give up their nuclear program was taken on by the Obama administration under circumstances which led the president, under the influence of some very hawkish advisors such as Dennis Ross and Gary Seymour, who was his advisor on weapons of mass destruction, for at least the first 4 years of his administration. Under their influence, Obama believed that if he put enough coercive pressure on Iran, he could succeed in getting the Iranians to give in on that issue. So, I mean, what happened was he failed, and he then was under pressure to reach an agreement and had to make compromises with Iran.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, and this new piece at The Nation, How the U.S. and Iran Reached Their Landmark Deal. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, The Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms.
This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism vs. Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism vs. Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. We're talking with Gareth Porter about the end of the manufactured crisis. It was Stephen Walt who observed and me who plagiarized him and repeated it 100 times about how it's the people who understand the reality, you know, us agendaless people, who understand the reality of Iran's nuclear program, who want the nuclear deal so bad just so we can put this giant fake controversy to bed, for crying out loud. And while the people who pretend to be afraid of Iranian nuclear weapons, the last thing they want is a real negotiation that would preclude the possibility of the Iranians being able to make a nuke anytime soon, because then they lose their giant fake controversy, which is their priority. And so I don't know how much things are going to change here. JDA in the chat room says it's not like WinEP is going away, and it's not like they have any other priority than an American war with Iran. That's the same as it's been this entire century long, right?
Well, I think you're right that you know, the people who have been pushing for war with Iran for years now are not going to just turn around and shut their doors. They have to come up with new variants on the theme to keep raising the issue that they have in the past. They will continue to do so. But let's face it, I mean, maybe the right way to put it is, let's enjoy this for what it is. This is a huge defeat for AIPAC, for the Israeli lobby. This is going to be reported that way, and it should be reported that way. They have anteed up an unprecedented amount of cash to try to defeat this. They have pulled out all the stops and they failed. Although, you know, they turned out an impressive number of members of Congress to support them, no question about it. But the bottom line is that this is a major failure. And, you know, I think that that's going to have some impact on the politics surrounding this without any question. And I think we're going to see a shift, from the nuclear issue toward terrorism without any question. I think we can anticipate that WinEP and a lot of other organizations like the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies are going to be focusing more and more on terrorism. Not that they haven't done it in the past, but, you know, I think that's going to be increasingly the propaganda theme.
Well, everybody get your DVRs warmed up for the day that they finally inspect Parchin and can't find a trace of a damn thing, because the whole deal was a hoax all along.
That is going to happen. That is going to happen without any question. And they won't find anything. And the answer that we're going to get, I'm safe in predicting, is, well, of course, they cleaned it all up. And of course, that's a complete total lie, because if there was, in fact, any nuclear material used to carry out tests, then it would not be anything that could be hidden. It could not be washed away or anything of the sort. That's a extremely well-documented fact.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it won't be reported by the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but it's a fact nevertheless.
Yeah. Yosef Butt, the nuclear physicist, wrote an article about it and talked about it on the show. If it was 24 days or 24 years, you're not going to be able to erase evidence of uranium. I mean, David Albright, of course, is just a punchline at this point. But his whole crisis, when he saw some Corning insulation, he said, oh, no, look, a pink tarp that's apparently covering up these guys washing away uranium particles with a garden hose, because I guess garden hoses are the most effective way to clean up radioactive particles.
Just to put a fine point
on
it.
Who's buying that?
The best thing for people to remember as a line to close arguments on this is that the IAEA's labs are able to find traces of uranium as small as 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram.
Yeah.
And I just leave it at that.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there was the other guy, Tariq Ralph came on the show and explained all that too, the process of how they examine it and all that. Now, Phil in the chat room is asking about, so what is next for the lobby? I mean, assuming they can get Congress to do what they want, the goal is what, to just add new layers of sanctions on them in the name of Hezbollah or anything else in order to just piss the Iranians off enough that they break their end of the deal? Is that the plan?
Certainly that will be part of it, yes. I mean, the poison pills that Ben Cardin has in mind in his legislation includes not only depriving the president of waiver authority, as that's the first priority, and of course that's not going to go anywhere, reauthorizing those sanctions that would otherwise or otherwise will expire in the coming months and years, and thirdly, adding new terrorism-related or other sanctions that would be regarded certainly as a violation of the agreement by the Iranians, and is clearly aimed precisely at provoking a rupture in the implementation of the agreement.
Yeah. All right. Now back to hoaxes for a minute here. Well, that's kind of still a continuing theme here when we're talking about Congress. But I want to get back to the Khobar Towers hoax. I read a piece by Paul Pillar, who is, you know, he seems to be working on trying to redeem himself for signing off on the Iraq NIE of 02. he's one of the best writers at the National Interest, although, of course, I'm still Doug Bandow first kind of guy. But the thing of it is, so I kind of like this guy. For a former CIA guy, he's no Phil Giraldi or Ray McGovern, but I kind of like him. I run him on antiwar.com all the time. But he ran this thing about how, yeah, Iran did Khobar Towers, but so what? And I thought, man, you can't really believe that Iran did the Khobar Towers. Or maybe he really does, and what the hell do I know? He's a CIA guy, so what do you say?
Yeah, I think he really believes that. He also believed that Iran carried out, or I assume he still believes that Iran carried out the Buenos Aires bombing. And I've had a bad bit of back and forth with him on this, and I'm not going to convince him, so there's
in
no
fact,
point.
In you know, I could be getting this wrong, but I don't think so. I think in that same article, he concedes maybe Buenos Aires.
Oh, really? Okay.
And maybe says, so. But Khobar, though.
I missed that, if he didn't.
Well, anyway, I put that in pencil, everybody. It was only a half-baked assertion for me, but I'm pretty sure that's the way I remember it.
I will check it out. I hope you're right. I hope you're right that that's the case. In which case I will, you know, give him even more credit for his flexibility. But, you know, I mean, he was in fact in the, counterterrorism center of the CIA at the time when the, Buenos Aires bombing was being investigated. And, I mean, at that point, that outfit was very strongly oriented towards the suspicion of Iran as the one that they should look for first for any terrorism activity around the world. They, as I point out in my piece in The Nation some years ago, 2008, I guess it was, the CIA as well as the FBI, basically based their analysis, their findings on suspicion, on inference. And it was inference from a set of assumptions that were false. And so, you know, that's kind of the way that operated. And he was part of it. And so it's not terribly surprising that he fell victim to a set of assumptions or conclusions about the things that they were investigating.
All right. Well, let me point out that in your work, you quote at least a handful of former FBI and CIA officials, including Michael Scheuer, saying, no, that was wrong. It was Osama that did it.
Well, Scheuer didn't say Osama did it, but
no?
He certainly shared with me an extremely important piece.
I'm pretty sure he said that on this show. That
well, he may have said it. He may have said it somewhere else. But that was not what he said to me. What he said was that he had had his unit, the Bin Laden unit at the CIA, come up with a 4-page memo that summarized all of the intelligence that they had collected after the Khobar Towers bombing. Before the Khobar Towers bombing, to show that there was a plan, there was an intention by Al-Qaeda to carry out another terror bombing after the November 1995 bombing in Riyadh, the National Guard office. So this was a very important set of a collection of intelligence indicators that Al-Qaeda was planning such a bombing, and that was totally ignored by the FBI and CIA. They refused to do anything to follow up on that very important set of leads, and that's indicative of the way in which they approached the whole problem.
Mm. Well, now, music's playing. Well, let's just keep recording for a minute here for later on, audience. The thing of it is, too, is Wayne Barrett has that piece, Rudy's Ties to a Terror Sheik, where he has, I forget now exactly what it is, but I think he does a pretty good job of showing that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was there and maybe with less certainty, but it looked like Osama bin Laden had been there, too, and that they were guests of this Qatari sheik who was basically right there adjacent to Khobar, basically on the other side of the border there, and that was the way that the attack had taken place. And in fact, I'm conflating Wayne Barrett with Peter Lance now, but I think Peter Lance says that the FBI sent the hostage rescue team, their special forces, the Waco killers, sent them to go and arrest Khalid Sheikh Mohammed there, but they were made by the Qatari princes to spend the night and wait till morning, and by morning, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was gone. And that was in 1996.
Bob Baer made the same point. He's the source, I'm not sure, but I remember he has that in his book for sure, that Al-Qaeda was being protected by the Sheikh in Qatar at that point.
Yeah, and that was Al-Thani who ended up, that was the article, Wayne Barrett's article was Rudy's Ties to a Terror Sheik, because this is the guy who hired Giuliani's firm to be his security consultant and pay him all this money, Mr. the mayor of 9/11 and all this crap.
Well, of course, the much more serious connection between the FBI the real problem in this whole business of Khobar Towers is that Louis Free, while he was still FBI director, was clearly, in bed with bin Laden, the head of the past head of Saudi intelligence, and at that point the Saudi ambassador in Washington, he was very seriously allowing himself to be influenced by what he was telling Free, and in the end he became the lawyer for the former head of Saudi intelligence, who was then, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name.
Are you talking about Prince Bandar?
Bandar, yeah. He's out of power now, but he was in and out of power many times over the last 30 years. He became Bandar's lawyer for a lawsuit where Bandar was accused of being involved in a scheme to rake off billions of dollars in a defense deal with the UK.
Makes you wonder how the hostage rescue team ever got sent after Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the first place at that point.
Well, there's a lot of questions surrounding the way the FBI and the CIA approached these issues during this period from the late 90s well into the last decade, for sure. It's a record of spectacular failure and really malfeasance to the point, and I'm sure you must have encountered this already in one of your interviews or maybe more than one, that the CIA's counterterrorism center actually, there's evidence, let me put it this way, there's strong evidence that the CIA's counterterrorism center before 9/11 was actively recruiting these two Al-Qaeda,
the San Diego guys.
The San Diego guys who were in the hijacking and the 9/11 bombing, because they, up to that point, had no agents within Al-Qaeda, and they were determined to get these guys as their agents. They would recruit them while they were in the States, send them back, and they would continue to be the CIA's agents. And they tried to keep that as long as they could, from the FBI. But the FBI did learn about it just before 9/11, 2 weeks before 9/11, and then the shit really hit the fan, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, so, I mean, at this point, that's almost sounds like a charitable explanation of why the CIA, for example, is not telling Richard Clark at the White House everything they knew about real-ass Al-Qaeda guys in this country,
right.
A direct threat to American citizens. So I wonder why you're so sure that was what it was, that they were trying to recruit him. Because the best I know is Richard Clark kind of rubbing his chin in the Rich Bleed podcast part two with right. Ray Noaleski saying, well, that must be it.
But yeah, Clark is the source of that. I mean, that is the most plausible explanation for all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it is Occam's razor, I guess, but yes. Horrible. Horrible, horrible. And then, you know, you get to the Bandar thing where, his wife cut a check to the San Diego cell. These are the pilots of Flight 77. And these are the guys who are calling back and forth to, it was Hani Hanjour, I think, it's his father-in-law ran the Al-Qaeda switchboard house in Yemen, that they were calling back all the time, that there was so much fighting about who was getting to hear those phone calls and what was taking place.
Well, I mean, of course, Clark makes a very strong case that what was going on here was that Saudi intelligence was acting as the agent for the CIA in making the contact and getting these guys enlisted. And I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And now, would that have been the Bin Laden unit? I guess Scheuer was in exile in the library at the time, but who would have been running that? That would have been a different group, huh?
That was counterintelligence, yeah.
Yeah.
It was an entirely different group, which had, of course, a different set of incentives going to push them in that direction, in that very, to say the least, morally questionable direction.
All right. Well, hey, man, I'm already almost back on again. So thanks for staying over time with me and doing the show again, Gareth.
No problem. Thanks, Sagat.
Appreciate
you later.
It. All right. That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. He wrote Manufactured Crisis and also How the U.S. and Iran Reached Their Landmark Deal. Behind the scenes, How the U.S. and Iran Reached Their Landmark Deal. That's at thenation.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Went a little bit over time there with Gareth. Good times. Coming up, Patrick Coburn talk about the horrible crisis in Syria and why it's all Uncle Sam's fault. Oh, damn. I did it again, but no more. Right now, I'm going to talk about Israeli nukes. I was going to say that in the segment before, and then I didn't get to it. And then I was going to bring it up during the Gareth Porter interview, and then I spaced it out again. But now I'm going to talk about it. Mordecai Vanunu, he is the heroic Israeli whistleblower who took a bunch of pictures of their nuclear weapons, their secret, illicit nuclear weapons program at Dimona, and leaked them to the Sunday Times of London back in 1986, I'm going to call it, maybe 85. And what he did was, maybe it was 83 or 84, actually, because, yeah. And what he revealed was to the world, the intelligence agencies of the world already knew, of course, but what he revealed to the world was that the Israelis have nukes, lots of them. Now, most current estimates range between 100 and 200. There was once an Air Force study where they said, well, maybe they have as many as 400. The highest number I've ever heard was from Daniel Ellsberg, who said on this show, and numerous times, because I think probably every time I interviewed him after that, at least two or three times after that, I asked him to go back over it again. I just want to make sure I'm quoting you right here. You're telling me it's hearsay, but damn, we're talking about Dan Ellsberg quoting Mordecai Vanunu directly. What Mordecai Vanunu told him. And Ellsberg told us on this show repeatedly that Mordecai Vanunu told him that the Israelis have as many as 600 nuclear weapons, including thermonuclear bombs, that is, H-bombs, fusion bombs, the tens of megaton-sized explosion-creating bombs. And of course, plus everybody knows, it's not even secret that they have German-supplied submarines providing them with second strike capability. 600 nukes. And in fact, somebody asked me about nukes. Oh, here he's answering me back on Twitter. He's saying that he is told that the U.S. does have nuclear weapons in the Netherlands. So, you know, when you list the nuclear weapon states, you got to include all the non-nuclear weapon states, but that are satellites of the United States Empire and have our nukes in their countries, like apparently the Netherlands. I didn't realize, but I guess I'm not surprised. And of course, there are American nukes in England and Germany as well, in Italy. Well, I guess I don't know for a fact they're in Italy, but I'm pretty damn sure they are. Not in France anymore. They got their own, and they had a fight about that back when, under De Gaulle. But anyway, so the nuclear powers in the world are basically the winners of World War II, the UN Security Council powers, right? The United States, Great Britain, France, Russia, and China. Plus, of course, India, Pakistan, and Israel, all of whom are outside the non-proliferation treaty. Oh, and of course, North Korea, too, needs to be added to the list. I sometimes forget to add North Korea because they're not actually proven to have figured out how to implode a plutonium bomb yet. They've done three tests, and the first two seemed to be fizzles, according to the best outside experts. And the third one, they just had not enough information to work with at all. It was buried too far underground, and there was no way really to tell whether it succeeded or not. But so they've done three tests, and none of them have been determined to be successes yet. Doing a Hiroshima-type uranium gun-type simple nuke is much, much easier than imploding a Nagasaki-type plutonium weapon. So, but anyway, I guess you can count them. Because of George W. Bush's bullying, they left the non-proliferation treaty and began to make nuclear weapons. And in fact, I saw someone yesterday on Twitter quoting Bill Clinton saying, this agreed framework with North Korea is just great, et cetera, you know, trying to make the joke that this is the kind of thing Obama is saying about our current deal and look how the North Korea deal worked out. But the truth is, the North Korea deal was working out great until George W. Bush personally, himself, deliberately ruined it. America broke and abrogated the agreed framework, not North Korea, using a bunch of fake excuses at the time, and then adding new sanctions on them, and basically forcing them, deliberately forcing them, to say, well, fine then, we're leaving the non-proliferation treaty, and we're going to start making nukes, if that's how you're going to be. Bill Clinton had a deal. George W. Bush killed it. So, we could have another situation like that where Obama gets a deal and Jeb comes in and ruins it. That's perfectly possible. But don't blame the deal. Blame the Bush. And the best article about that? It's by Gordon Prather at Antiwar.com. In fact, I believe it's his last article for Antiwar.com. Let me see about that. Prather. No, it's not. I got that wrong, sorry. Anyway, it's a great essay, and it's called How Bush Pushed North Korea to Nukes. how Bush pushed North Korea to nukes. And there's all you need to know right there. False accusations of North Korea, unproven, probably false accusations about North Korea violating some terms of it, not abrogating the deal and saying enough, but possibly violating it. But they didn't prove it. They just accused them. Then they created the new extra-legal proliferation security initiative, which was the claimed right to seize North Korean boats on the high seas and make sure they're not sending weapons to Syria or some crap. And then the third one was a whole new level of sanctions, all the while George Bush is personally insulting Kim Jong-il, calling him a pygmy. Not that Bush is a bigot or anything, but calling him a pygmy and saying, I hate him, I despise him, he's horrible, I don't mean to do business with him. In fact, there's great video. Man, whose documentary is this in? We're right at the beginning of the Bush administration. Colin Powell gave this huge speech about, here's what our foreign policy is going to be. And Bush and Cheney, and he goes on and on and on and on and on. And Bush and Cheney are standing there, and Bush is bored, and Cheney's looking at Powell like, yeah, that's what you think. You know, we'll see who wins in this turf war. And of course, Cheney beat out Powell quick. Powell's take was, hey, we got a great deal with North Korea, we're going to keep it and act on it. And Cheney's deal was, no, we're going to try to come up with an excuse for a war. Instead, what'd he do? He just pushed them to nuclear weapons. No regime change. No war to prevent them from getting nukes, just a path to provoke them into getting them. It's a great a half a plan you got there, Mr. Dick. But anyway, Israel's nukes, that's the point. Guess what? Have you ever heard of the Samson option? Go look at the Samson option. Seymour Hersh wrote about it. There's other journalism about it. And here's, you won't even believe me, it's crazy, but you'll just have to hear me now and believe it later when you know it because you read it somewhere credible. But it does sound unbelievable, I'll admit. The Israelis have basically said to the Western powers, you must be our allies, and you must protect us. And if Israel is ever threatened with being overrun by, say, a combined Arab state invasion, and the Americans and the Europeans, if you don't come to our aid, then we will nuke all of your capital cities. As we're overrun, we will nuke Rome and Berlin and Paris and London and Washington, D.C. And how do you like that? That is Israeli policy. To nuke the capitals of all of their allies. If their allies ever let them down in a pinch. The Samson option. Pull in the walls of the temple on your own head to defeat all your enemies too. National suicide kamikaze. Like they're always trying to accuse the Iranians of. Go look that up, the Samson option. You think I could even think of making up such nonsense? You'd have to be an Israeli with a nuke to even imagine such a thing. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, I'll be talking about the wars. I'll be talking with Patrick Coburn about the war in Syria. Well, and the Islamic State in general. In fact, I was going to talk about this, but now I realize I should put this story off until the Coburn interview. I'll tell you what it is, at least. The piece being Nancy Youssef at the Daily Beast. 50 spies say ISIS intelligence cooked. and the ISIS intelligence being cooked to paint a rosy picture. When in fact, the situation over there is worse than they say. And I'm buying that, and the reason why really is because Patrick. Patrick's been saying, hey, when they say 20, 30,000 foot soldiers, no, man, I'm telling you. It's been more than a year. They have conscription. They have taxation. When the Kurds say they have at least 100,000 foot soldiers, you know, Prothero said the same thing too. Look, they're fighting in Baji. They're fighting here. They're fighting there. They're fighting in Kobani and, you know, they're occupying Raqqa and this, that, the other thing. You add these up, you're talking certainly more than 50,000 men. Maybe 100,000. My thing is, I just don't care. In fact, I'll tell you, I'm disappointed. Professionally, I don't care either way. But personally, I'm kind of disappointed because you may know Patrick has been saying lately that the U.S. and Britain ought to help Assad defeat the Islamic State and al-Nusra. And the reason why is because to him, you know, whatever smear they said about Saddam, as bad as he was, it's all true about ISIS. I mean, these guys are so fanatical, they must be stopped. And I don't believe that. I reject that. Must be stopped by the U.S. and Britain? No, man. Can't be the answer to this. And, you know, do nothing might sound, I mean, to a warmonger or a warmonger's propaganda victim, like saying, well, just F those people. But to me, it's more like, you know, taking the time to figure out whose fault this all is and how much we can honestly expect those very same people, the governments of the U.S. and Britain, to fix the problem that they created. And look at what they've done to Syria. There's no side to take. There are no mythical moderates on any side. I've cited for you before Michael Scheuer, who, of course, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, and a real hawk, who a lot of the times will say horrible things about just go in there and just kill them. And anybody who happens to be near them, because we ain't got the time or the money for screwing around. Blast them, kill them all, blah. As long as they're not Americans and it's a legitimate interest in defense of the American people, there's no limit to the violence that he will support, right? He's a non-interventionist, but he's no, you know, libertarian. He's an American nationalist when it comes to, you know, who's got a right to keep breathing or not. And I only say that to explain why it's, should sound a little ironic and should be instructive when, I quote him, saying, no, we should not back Assad against the Islamic State, as upset as he is about al-Nusra and the Islamic State, as much as he would like to see all of their heads crushed. He says, if we back Assad, then we play into their narrative. The Americans, the Zionists, the Crusaders, the Zionists and the Shia all working together. We drive more people into their arms by allying with their enemies. For God's sake, stop fighting against Assad. Stop arming and funding Mujahideen who are fighting him. But don't back him. Don't take his side. That's counterproductive. Same thing is going on in Iraq right now. The more we send America and Iran, send the Shiite militias against the Sunni places, the Sunni-dominated parts of former Iraq, the more they're driven into the arms of the Islamic State. They're, you know, war is the health of the state, right? They're being attacked by the Shiite death squads that, you know, hell, probably half the population of Fallujah are refugees from Baghdad anyway. Now, here are the same guys that kicked you out of your home are coming now to liberate you from the Islamic State with the help of the Americans and the Iranians. Yeah, right. So it's all just counterproductive. Unless we send a full-scale invasion force in there again to fight against the Islamic State, to occupy, you know, not just Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul, but Raqqa too, then there's nothing we can do about it. And even if we did that, then we'd have to stay forever and ever, because the moment we leave, well, look, people outside of our control come back to power again. So I mean, god dang, the lesson here has got to be to just knock it off. You know, compare it to the Pottery Barn rule, you know, Colin Powell. And this never was the rule at Pottery Barn, by the way. This is a terrible smear against the Pottery Barn. But Colin Powell says, hey, Pottery Barn rule, if you break it, you own it. You have to fix it. You're obligated to stay there and occupy it until it's good. But so take it to the Pottery Barn. If you're, you know, O.J. Simpson from The Naked Gun, a big klutz, and you're stomping around in there knocking things off the shelf, and all you're trying to do is clean it up, but all you do is keep knocking more things off the shelf and breaking more and more things in your hapless, pathetic attempt to clean it up, and the owner tells you, hey, beat it. I'll clean it up. You're hereby disinvited from helping. So just stop, then you're obligated to do that. See, you don't own it. He owns it. Still. It's up to him to tell you to get lost or not. And the only people inviting us back over there are the Iranians who want us to fly as their Air Force. And right now, and then, I mean, that's in Iraq. In Syria, it's more like the al-Nusra Front. Al-Qaeda wants us to fly as their Air Force. Just like the Turks are doing right now, bombing the Kurds for them. And so, whose side are you supposed to take in that? How about nobody's? How about, man, if there has ever been a better time and place snapshot in history where you could say, hey, look, American intervention in other people's countries really sucks and never does any good, cannot help, then today's the day. This year is the year where the lesson has got to be learned that, boy, if these crises are ever going to simmer down, it's going to have to be solved at a local level. I'm sorry I repeat myself all the time, but it's just like government intervention in the economy. Government intervention in which groups have what amount of guns and what amount of territory that never was theirs to control and this kind of thing is just a distortion, a bubble, that when it's no longer being financed by our Fed and no longer being backed by our army, pops and leads to snapback, if you want, blowback and backdraft and worse problems. And of course, you know, that's really good if you're in the government business, but it's really bad for everybody else. And now look at the crisis point that it's at, where they're really, with a straight face, comparing the refugee crisis on Earth right now to the aftermath of World War II. Virtually all of this at the hands of the United States.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time. Full archives at scotthorton.org. Next guest today is the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent in Britain. You can also find his archive at UNS.com, U-N-Z, UNS.com. Three very important recent pieces. Only a U.S.-Russian agreement can spur a settlement in Syria. Refugee crisis. Where are all these people coming from and why? And ISIS are threatening to capture a vital highway in Syria. And it goes on like that. Those are just the three latest there. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing really good. I really appreciate you joining us here. And if we could start with the highway there, you know, a little bit of a lay of the battlefield in Syria. Who's making what progress at whose expense right now? Could you sketch us a thumbnail there?
Islamic State, ISIS, has taken more than half of Syria now. They've got all the east of the country, apart from that part which is held by the Kurds. West of there, you have the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. In the north, you have Jabhat al-Nusra and the various al-Qaeda-type organizations. Now, what's important is that, you know, as people know, I think that ISIS captured Palmyra, this famous ancient city, on 22nd of May. This was at a time, let me say, that the senior U.S. officers in charge of the campaign against ISIS were announcing that they'd got its measure and they'd stopped it, and then it captured Ramadi in Iraq and Palmyra in Syria. Since then, they've advanced westwards, and they're now about 20 miles from a really crucial road, the north-south road in called the M5. It's links Damascus north to cities like Homs and Hama and Aleppo and the coast. It would be really serious if ISIS cut this road. They're only 20 miles away from it. So that's a big change on the battlefield. I don't think that Assad will sort of implode like Gaddafi in Libya or the Iraqi army in 2003, but the situation has got very serious. They've also lost their last remaining oil field, so they're being squeezed. But the people who are winning are ISIS, Islamic State. They're getting stronger.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now the Turks have been pushing for a so-called safe zone in northern Syria on and off again over the last 4 years. But now it seems like there's some talk of NATO going ahead and going along with that. But then I saw some headlines that said that ISIS preempted them by rolling right into that area that was supposed to become the safe zone. Is safe zone, does that just mean no-fly zone, by the way? Or can you tell us the status of that?
Well, the Turks wanted a sort of no-fly zone, which directed against Assad and the Syrian government. But it actually seems to have been directed against the Kurds. The Kurds were doing pretty well against ISIS, advancing south and west. And the Turks wanted to stop them moving west to the Euphrates River. And so it was partly directed against them. The U.S. has never gone along with the idea of a safe zone. You know, there was the Turks were talking about it being taken over by opposition, but the only opposition around, I'm afraid, is Jabhat al-Nusra and the al-Qaeda clones. The U.S. was trying to build up a moderate force, but, you know, as you may have seen, that it was pretty tiny. 54 guys had been trained, and they were immediately ambushed by Jabhat al-Nusra. So there's really nobody there except al-Qaeda types to take over this free zone or ISIS to advance into it.
And now, by the way, speaking of these groups, I mean, of course, al-Nusra and ISIS both are outgrowths of al-Qaeda in Iraq, basically the next generation of al-Qaeda in Iraq. But when they talk about Ahrar al-Sham, and they talk about the Free Syrian Army, which, you know, obviously sounds like a pretty Western name for the group in the first place. But they've come and gone repeatedly over the years. We hear that, well, they all just went ahead and joined al-Nusra. And then a couple of months later, we hear, yeah, the FSA went and fought a battle again. And, I just wonder if you could, I mean, I know you say that there's not a dime's worth of difference between Ahrar al-Sham and, al-Qaeda as far as their beliefs and all that kind of thing. But, could you, first of all, compare their numbers for us, give us some kind of ballpark about how big these different groups are, and then, you know, maybe how well they work with the U.S. versus with the Islamic State, that kind of thing, because that's really the argument that the war party makes here, is that even David Petraeus is coming out and saying we should peel off the moderate members of al-Nusra, who really don't care about Zawahiri either way, and use them against the rest of al-Nusra and the Islamic State.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, you know. I mean, these Islamic State, al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, you know, people, their ideology is pretty well the same. You know, these are fundamentalist Sunni Muslims. They want to impose Sharia law. They do impose Sharia law. Jabhat al-Nusra was trying to present itself a little bit more moderate, so their leader gave an interview and said, well, we wouldn't kill all Alawites, which is a Shia sect in Syria. But of course, they'd have to convert to his particular variant of Islam. And about the same time, when some Druze, some villagers objected to this forcible conversion, they're immediately massacred. So there isn't a great deal of difference in the ideology between these people. Their numbers, I don't really know. There are differences over how big ISIS is. I'd say sort of 50,000 plus, Kurds and others would say, larger. The CIA has said less. I don't think really people really know in Iraq and Syria how many people they can actually send into the front line. Likewise the other groups, but in the tens of thousands. So I think that this attempt to say that, you know, they're kind of moderate Al-Qaeda guys. Let me take an example. Arar al-Sham, about 18 months ago, ISIS suicide bomber blew up some of their leaders, including their deputy leader. Then it turned out that the deputy leader of Arar al-Sham, the more moderate jihadis, happened to be the representative, the main representative of Al-Qaeda in Syria. So, you know, these guys, they're all pretty similar.
Well, and it sure seems like the government has known this all along. Of course, you've been writing about this, and I've been interviewing you about this on the show all along since before this, since the start of this war, basically. And I saw where you cited also this recent DIA report that was uncovered that Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who's now out of the DIA, who was the commander at the time, has verified the import of this memo in an interview with Al Jazeera, saying, yes, this was on my desk and we took it seriously. And I took it to the White House and I argued based on this memo that by backing the rebellion against Assad and pushing regime change against Assad, we are de facto creating an Islamic State. He didn't say, you know, we own Baghdadi, the Islamic State. But he said, we're creating an Islamic State in eastern Syria, and we're in danger of it actually taking over western Iraq as well, since that's lawless, uncontrolled Sunnistan right now, just a giant power vacuum waiting for them to come back. And that memo is from 2012. I was joking at the time. I bet we could go back and find an interview of me interviewing you from probably that same day or that same week saying the same thing in that DIA report, that this is the crazy fire that we're playing with here, backing our enemies.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy, isn't it? Because, you know, all that was pretty obvious at the time. That the armed opposition from an early stage was taken over by extreme jihadis, Al-Qaeda types. This wasn't really reflected in most of the media coverage, but it was pretty evident on the ground. But they haven't really had a policy then. They don't really have a policy now. You know, they're attacking. Most effective opponent of Islamic State in Syria was the Syrian Kurds. But then the U.S. has just done a deal with the Turks, which is primarily directed against the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is the organizing party and militia of the Syrian Kurds. So, the outcome of this deal is in the interests, ultimately, of Islamic State and against that of their opponents. Again, that's sort of pretty crazy. There's a sort of lack of any sort of coherent policy towards combating the so-called caliphate, which is why it's still getting bigger.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that the President of the United States, even just 3 or 4 weeks ago, I guess now, reiterated for the first time since 2012, I think, that Assad must step aside. Which is just a giant poison pill, making sure that no negotiation will be possible. And I guess since then, though, now, Putin came forward even after that and said that that Assad would be willing to negotiate and would be willing to share power with, you know, decent opposition, healthy opposition, Putin said, I guess was the translation. Is there anybody for him to negotiate with? Is there a real possibility of a peace treaty?
Well, there, you can find people to negotiate with. The problem is they don't have any power on the ground.
Right,
you
know, yeah.
Quite lots of people in,
yeah, in hotels,
hotels
in Qatar.
In Istanbul and Ankara and other parts who are very happy to come and negotiate. The problem is that, you know, if they go back to the opposition part of Syria, they'll lose their heads. They don't really have any. They don't have any power. I think that, you know, what's the policy of the U.S.? Well, what would they really like to do? Well, they'd like to get rid of Assad, but they want to maintain the Syrian state, i.e., they want to do what they didn't do in Iraq in 2003 and 4, when they got rid of Saddam and then found they dissolved the Iraqi state, and then Al Qaeda and other movements like that moved in. But actually, they could do that, because if they simply announced that they were going to, when Islamic State attacks from Palmyra, to say, you know, we will be acting against Islamic State and we'll be acting for the Syrian army. We're not defending Assad. They've been trying this would be quite effective. They would be supporting the Syrian state. They wouldn't be supporting Assad. But basically, they don't seem to have any policy. They seem to have ceded it partly to Saudi Arabia. They want to kind of keep in with their traditional Sunni allies, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf monarchies, Turkey. They don't want to offend these people. And that makes it impossible to have a real counterattack against Islamic State.
Mm. Well, and now, so if we could switch to the eastern front of the Islamic State in what used to be called Iraq, the war between southern Shiistan and the Islamic State there, it seems like, well, there's very little coverage of it, but it was announced quite a few weeks ago that they're launching a major siege against Fallujah, a major attack on the Islamic State in Fallujah and Ramadi both at the same time. Sounded kind of funny because they can't seem to keep a hold of the apparently now worthless Baiji refinery or the adjacent town, the very small town of Baiji, but now they're launching full-scale assaults on Fallujah and Ramadi, except I can't read a thing about it because nobody's covering it. So can you tell us what you think's going on there?
It's kind of a stalemate. They took Ramadi. There's no real counterattack. What's U.S. policy? Well, to try and build up the Iraqi army and try and create a Sunni sort of second force, which is going to be opposed to Islamic State. But, you know, this is trying to revive an old policy that from about 2006-07, the surge, and think you can do all that again. That sort of only half worked when there were 150,000 American soldiers in Iraq. It's really very unlikely to work now. And the Iraqi state, the Iraqi army, you know, it's dysfunctional. It's incredibly corrupt. It's really a sort of, it's going nowhere. And, at the same time, suspicion of the Shia militias and as being under Iranian influence. There isn't really an effective policy, and the Islamic State stays where it is. I don't think it'll expand because it depends. It comes out of the Sunni Arab community. They're about 20% of Iraqis, 20% Kurds, and 60% Iraqi Shia. So I think it's difficult for it to expand in Iraq, unlike Syria, which is 60% Sunni Arab. Mm-hmm. But they're not retreating either. At some point, of course, the Shia militias may counterattack up the Euphrates Valley. The Euphrates Valley is really the heart of the caliphate. But that isn't happening yet. So you kind of have this kind of stalemate. But Iraqis feeling pretty demoralized. I think about 450,000 have left this year. There are 17 or 18 flights to Istanbul every day full of people leaving. There's a sort of sense of demoralization and things getting worse. You don't really hear about it so much as Syrian refugees, but there's a smaller but still very significant exodus from there.
Mm. Well, you know, it's pretty contrary to the narrative in Washington, D.C. about just how much we're all supposed to hate Iran and Assad and especially Putin in Russia. But it sort of seems to me like a perfect place, a perfect time and place for the Americans to completely butt out of the Middle East, especially now that we got Russians on the ground, apparently obligated to helping Assad survive. Let them fight our stupid war on terror for us. Perfect time to let the Russians make themselves the enemy of these guys for a while and leave us the hell alone. And since apparently all America can do is make everything worse and worse and worse, whether we're fighting against Al-Qaeda or whether we're fighting for them, we're making them more powerful every day.
Yeah, but I, you know, this story about the Russians moving in, you know, when you go into it, it's got very little substance. There's a photograph around, some video around about one Russian armored personnel carrier, fairly modern make. And there's a very brief conversation, which may be in Russian, might be in Arabic, could be in English. Nobody's quite sure. Very sort of incoherent for people saying the Eshil Raz in Russian, or maybe they were saying something in Arabic. That's the evidence for more Russian troops. There's some shots from pictures from Jabhat al-Nusra showing some MiG-29s, but the Syrian Air Force uses those as well. Pretty insubstantive. You know, the Russians have never been had a big base there. You know, people used to talk about the Russian naval base at Tartus. In 2013, how many Russians were there? Four. This was the great big base. So there's a lot of sort of fantasy and a sort of exaggeration coming out of reporting from Moscow and Beirut on this. I suppose the Russians might send more. You know, they supply, they arm the Syrian army. They might do more. But I don't think they're going to send many troops there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's in the Washington Post version. Oh, the Russians confirm their presence, but yeah, the unnamed number of advisors, but nothing beyond
that.
Yeah,
this is okay, you know, sort of Cold War revisited, you know, the Russian advisors moving into some country, fantastic excitement, you know. Yeah. But I think it mostly baloney. It might happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Now, so Ayman al-Zawahiri put out a podcast the other day where he said, look, I don't recognize the caliphate as being legitimate by the book or anything like that. However, the Shia and the Crusaders are worse, and so I think we ought to fight with them. Now, mostly in the media, the spin seems to be, oh, Zawahiri talks bad about the Islamic State. But it seemed to me like what he was saying was, you know, we ought to be getting along better. And he's trying to head off the idea of the rehabilitation of Syria and Al-Qaeda, the al-Nusra Front, as the moderates here, and saying, you know, we're better off fighting with the Islamic State against the Americans and with the Americans against the Islamic State. And, you know, I'm not sure if you saw this, Patrick, but there was an article about Stanley Cohen, the Jewish human rights lawyer from New York, who was negotiating through some contacts that he had through Kuwait and Jordan in order to try to get one of the hostages released. And in the course of the negotiation, part of it was he was healing a rift between an Al-Qaeda cleric and an ISIS cleric. And the ISIS cleric was the student of the Al-Qaeda cleric, and they had this big disagreement, and they were actually working it out. And they were actually going to patch up, or were apparently pretty near patching up the split. And then the Americans swooped in and scotched the negotiation, and the hostage was beheaded. Was how it worked out. But the point being, it seems like not only these guys very much alike, it seems like at any time they might go ahead and combine their forces. And Zawahiri and Baghdadi maybe could kiss and make up here.
First of all, they're viscerally anti-American on all sides. You know, you can't, if you're sort of jihadi, you can't, it's kind of, it's not, back in Iraq, you know, you could get sort of Iraqi Sunni tribes to ally themselves with America. When you're dealing with jihadis, you know, who have a whole sort of ideology in which the U.S. and non-Muslims or people who aren't belong to their particular variant of Islam are regarded as heretics or are all demonized. So it's pretty difficult for these guys to sort of shift over and suddenly become allied to the Americans without losing a lot of support or getting killed. So I think that all this sort of this idea that somewhere there's a sort of moderate Al-Qaeda faction, you know, is just sort of crazy.
Well, how likely do you think it is that al-Nusra or Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State will heal their rift and join back together again? And I guess what difference do you think it'll make?
You know, these guys that have killed each other, you know, they're off to par, but it's sort of, you know, it's ideology isn't much different, but they, you know, they're both all bidding for power. And they've killed a lot of each other. So I can't see them sort of suddenly, and these are very sort of savage, you know, cruel people. So I can't see them, you know, kissing and making up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't see them becoming sort of suddenly moderates or allied to the Americans. You know, you have, while you have the whole opposition basically dominated with these people, this sort of works militarily against Assad, but politically it doesn't quite, because the people who are in Assad's corner, who, you know, aren't really pro-Assad, but they prefer, they don't have any choice. They prefer him to the alternative, which is basically losing their heads. As so long as the opposition is all dominated by these people, then people who are in a corner with Assad have got no alternative but to fight with him.
Mm. Yeah, I know a Syrian who said everybody hates Assad, but they back the army. You know, which is protecting
them
from these guys.
It might be a good idea to go and help the Syrian army when they're fighting Islamic State. You know? Because at the moment, if people think in Damascus, well, Assad goes, probably, you know, the army will begin to break up. There'll be, you know, nobody, you know, uniting anything.
Right.
And the next thing is we'll have Al-Qaeda and Islamic State here, you know, killing all the Alawites, the Christians, and the Sunni who are in Damascus. Remember, you know, there are cities in like Tartus that used to be Alawite. They're now mostly Sunni because they're full of Sunni who fled from Islamic State.
Mm.
Any Sunni, you know, who sort of may not like Assad, but they're even more terrified of Islamic State, or they work for the army, or they work for the government. They're all vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is a way of combating Islamic State, but, you know, Washington, London, the others, Paris, they really haven't done this. They haven't, when it comes to the crunch, they won't stand up against sort of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. They won't do various obvious things. That's why Islamic State is still there.
And now, speaking of which, you mentioned earlier that unlike in Iraq, in Syria, it's a 60% majority Sunni population. And of course, it's the state is certainly backed by the minority secular coalition of the Druze and the Christians and the Shia and the Alawites, you mentioned. I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to ask, what percent of the Sunnis of Syria support the state versus the revolution? Because they painted in very kind of black and white sectarian terms, as though all Sunnis are on the side of the revolution.
Yeah, this is sort of, you know, if that was true, they'd have taken over, you know, 3 years ago. I mean, a diplomat in Damascus said to me, look, you know, you've got three factions. You've got the government, then you've got the anti-government, and then you've got people who are anti the anti-government, i.e., you know, a very large constituency of people who don't much like the government, but they're even more terrified of the government's opponents. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to sort of factor this in.
So would you say that's a majority of the Sunnis of Syria?
I wouldn't know, but I think, you know, then you have people who are, you know, have been bombed. The government, you know, has been barrel bombing. What happens when the opposition takes over an area? The government says, oh, we're going to bomb that area. Everybody should get out. And then they treat anybody in there as being an enemy. So they drop, you know, barrels full of explosives and artillery and everything else on that area. They devastate. You go through North Damascus. I've driven through there. You know, it's like sort of pictures you've seen of Dresden or Hamburg in 1945. You know, just heaps of ruins everywhere, just mile after mile. Scary place to drive. Opposition places, you know, they've just been shattered. It should also be said the opposition, you know, they don't have the same firepower, but they quite happily fire guns into in Aleppo, into the big artillery, into the, government side. It's also completely indiscriminate. I stay normally in the Christian place called Babtuma, which is Christian part of the old city. You know, we have mortar bombs coming. We've had, when I've been there before, there's always been mortar bombs coming in, not for a few a day, a few people killed, badly injured and so forth. Again, completely indiscriminate. Has Assad has killed more civilians? Yeah, definitely, but he's got more firepower. But would the opposition, if they had more firepower, do the same? You know, all signs are yes.
Yeah. And again, you know, back to the refugee crisis here real quick. You mentioned how bad it's getting. It seems like, and you made the comparison, too, to the de-Ba'athification of the Iraqi army and the abolition of the Iraqi army. And maybe that they're trying to skirt around and regime change just Assad, but not accomplish that. It looks like, you know, they're not going to be able to have their cake and eat it, too, kind of deal here. And that's really, you know, if Nusra and ISIS do much better, they're already at the outskirts of Damascus. If they're actually able to get rid of Assad, how in the world do the Western powers think that they're going to keep the state, though, but not Assad? I mean, obviously, at that point, the jihadists are going to completely overthrow the government and dissolve the army, etc., try to take it over. And at that point, that's when the real refugee crisis begins, right? We haven't even got to the regime change part of this nightmare story yet. You know, the real problem starts when basically every last Christian, Druze, Shia, Alawi, and a lot of the Sunnis too, all will have individually death marks on their head, convert or die at the hands of Al-Qaeda in Syria.
Sure, yeah. Sure, yeah, you know, if you feel 4 million refugees out of the country at the moment, you know, ISIS takes the main road, begins to take Damascus, these other cities, you know, you'll have the same number, you'll have a larger number trying to get out of the country. I don't know if they'll be able to get out, but there'll be the same tremendous pressures. I think that other things might happen. I don't think the Russians, I don't think the Iranians, I think the Shia community in the Middle East, particularly in Lebanon, you know, they see the battle for Syria as being a battle they can't afford to lose. So ISIS increases their strength, then they'll up the ante too. So I don't see Islamic states that are taking over like they did in Mosul in June last year in Iraq. But I do see a lot more fighting. I think they're advanced. I think that then the Shia in Iraq, in Iran, in Lebanon will try and counter that. I don't think they'll let Assad go down. So, you know, the future is really one of more war.
All right, Joe, that is the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. His latest book is The Rise of Islamic State, and you can find his archive also at UNS.com. That's UNZ, UNS.com. Only a U.S.-Russia agreement can spur a settlement in Syria. Refugee crisis. Where are all these people coming from and why? Etc., etc., UNS.com. Thanks very much for your time, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.